Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to part one of our Giant Killers series. We did a little bit of FA Cup nostalgia and content last year with each round of the Cup as it went along. This season, we're looking at specific giant killing incidents all the way through to the final at Wembley. The third round, so synonymous with so many massive Cup upsets. I think every team can point to one. And I was a Liverpool supporter. I know people old enough to shudder at the thought of Worcester I think it was 57 or so, late 50s anyway. And they've all the giants have been killed, have been slayed at some point in the FA Cup, and it's unforgiving, especially in its unforgiving early rounds. The third round, though, is most synonymous with this fixture. And we will put the Aidan Williams klaxon on this one, as it is his beloved Newcastle United being turfed out of the 1972 FA Cup by the magnificent Hereford United. Dave Bowler, welcome, Dave. Looking forward to this one.
Very much so. This is obviously I've got no horse in this race particularly, but this is one of the great games of all time. I was 7 or 8 when all this happened, and it's still. You know, the match of the day from that game is still sort of burned onto my memory all these years later, unlike pretty much anything else, actually.
It is the game that has it all. I'll bring in Bill Hearn. Bill, you know, as a Sunderland fan, you particularly enjoy this one, but this is the iconography of it is quite something else. You know, the pitch itself, the wonderfully egotistical Malcolm McDonald punching the air in disgust at the miss at 1-1. It's the team that has won the Intercities Fur Cup just 3 years earlier. They are just over 2 years away from reaching the FA Cup final, 1974 final. This is a Newcastle United. They've paid £180,000, huge outlay of its time for Malcolm McDonald. This is the game. I mean, just for the snorkel parkers alone, the supporters up in the trees outside the ground. John Motson's big breakthrough game. It's got that screamer that we'll come to all of this with our special guest in a few minutes. But this is it's difficult to think of a more iconic, certainly in the television era, and certainly the colour television era.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, they've spent a lot of money, and there are a lot of parallels with now, isn't there? You know, they were a mid-table First Division side then, and they remain a mid-table First Division side. But yeah, iconic, you know, the Ronnie Radford goal, who can forget that? And as you say, the Parkers running on the pitch when the goals were scored, again, you know, completely unforgettable. So yeah, it was a good day.
Absolutely, and that brings us to... the wonderful Keith Hall, who has agreed to join us for this one. Keith is the editor of Talking Bull, the Hereford fanzine. He also tips up on Hereford and Worcester Radio, commentating on games. Keith, thank you so much for joining us. Does it get any bigger than Hereford's victory against Newcastle United in your heart?
I don't think it'll ever be repeated. It was a magical time to be following a club. I was 12. At the time, and my father, who was a postman, actually queued up, and believe it or not, it was one person, one ticket. This is for the replay against Newcastle. He had to queue up 6 hours to get his ticket, join the back of the queue, and get me another ticket. So, I mean, hats off to him for the dedication to make sure that I was at the game. But it was a tremendous time to be supporting Hereford, all the way through the 70s, pretty much, but from the John Charles era right through to when Hereford were playing the likes of Wolves and Southampton in the Championship, as it is these days, in the second division. So it was a real bandwagon sort of roll through the 70s.
Absolutely fantastic. First question I think anyone listening would want to know, Were you wearing a parka that day, Keith? And did you make it onto the pitch?
I was wearing a parka and I did make it onto the pitch. Incidentally, I was actually at the Newcastle end on a hay bale because there were so many people who wanted to go to the game. They just put hay bales, school benches down, anything that could get people into the ground. And yeah, it was, yeah, occasionally you got a bit of beer thrown all over you, or toilet rolls, I seem to remember at the time from that position. But yeah, it was, normally I'd be at the Meadow end, but those tickets went fairly quickly, so you got what you got, really.
Excellent. And as a point of interest, colour of parka, was it a green one, or are we going navy?
It's a sort of beigey green. I sort of can't beigey remember green, what colour, yeah, you would call it, really.
Yeah, well,
nondescript colour.
I'm colourblind. They're either kind of like navy blue or green to me. I've got a green one now that I've worn today because of the cold weather.
Maybe khaki green would be a better description. That's probably
khaki green. We'll go with that one. Yeah, excellent. Excellent. Dave, have you got your parka all set for this one?
I think I've outgrown mine many, many, many years ago. Mine was navy blue, naturally, for the Albion.
Obviously. And Bill, were you an aficionado of the snorkel parka?
I was. Yes, and mine was green.
Excellent.
And I remember later buying a sheepskin and looking like John Motson. I've still got it, but I would never wear it. Can I just mention Talking Bull?
Yes.
It's a fantastic fanzine, and it was one of the all time greats. And I remember going down to Sports Pages in Charing Cross Road and buying lots and lots of fanzines. But Talking Bull was always one of the greats, and it still is. So if anybody's listening, it really is a great fanzine. Don't be put off by Hereford's lowly position. It's a great piece of work, really, really is.
Brilliant. I fully agree with that. I come from a fanzine background. And get out there and get your club fanzines across wherever you get them from. But yeah, take a look at Hereford's, most definitely. I mean, Keith, if you can take us through Hereford's route to the third round, the games that had taken them to this plateau, not plateau, but this great moment of taking on Newcastle.
Well, I think it was Gloucester and then King's Lynn, Northampton. It was an epic game to get through into the third round proper. I'm trying to recall exact dates and goal scorers, but I do remember the goal very, very late at the Hawthorns, because in those days there were replays in the FA Cup, second replays as well. And so we went onto a neutral ground at the Hawthorns to beat Northampton and got a very, very late winner there to get a game against Newcastle. And we haven't mentioned that Hereford drew at Newcastle. The game at Hereford was actually the third round replay, having already drawn 2-2 on Newcastle's hallowed turf up in the northeast. So it just sort of gathered momentum as things went through. And a lot of the players were experienced Football League players. So it wasn't as though they'd been, come from nowhere as a part-time carpenters and all the rest of it. Yes, they were, some of them, but they had got vast experience in the league. Had to look at Colin Addison and likes of Ken Mallander. Got plenty of experience, even in the first division with Arsenal. So these were really good players that had dropped down the leagues and found their home at Hereford.
There were lots of postponements, Keith, wasn't there? How was that for a 12-year-old looking forward to the match, only to find it had been postponed again and again?
Well, I think it was six times it was postponed. And Newcastle came down, I think they stayed in a hotel, actually, in Worcester for quite a number of days, and they weren't sure whether the game was on. They had to go back up to the northeast and come back down. So it must have been really relentless for them to try and get this game on. But, eventually, Hereford showed their grit, have to go and be a goal behind to Malcolm McDonald. But you have to look at the 2-2 draw at Newcastle in isolation. That was a tremendous result as well, Hereford scoring first, Addison getting an equaliser to make it 2-2. I think 39,000, I think it was, at Newcastle back then. So, they faced the first division side on their own ground and came away with a result.
I mean, Dave, the third round, the initial game, I mean, I've not found any footage of it, but I've read match reports on it. And Hereford get, a lot of credit from the Nationals in their match reports. This could have just simply been Hereford winning at St James Park, rather than what we view it as the third round replay that was actually played on fourth round weekend that season.
I spoke to Colin Addison about these games and about Hereford generally 5, 10 years ago, I think he was. I mean, you've got to remember that Hereford was quite an ambitious club at this point. Yeah, they were Southern League and all of that. But they'd had the great John Charles as manager prior to Colin coming in. You know, Colin came from Sheffield United. I think United was still in the first division at that point, maybe just got relegated in the second, I can't quite remember. So, you know, they were looking at greater things, I think. And he made a big point that they wanted to do things properly. You know, they wanted to approach it as though it was a professional team. It was, you know, the sort of stuff Colin remembered from his days at Arsenal, really. You know, they'd gone up there with the, you know, the full team. They put the families, I think, on a train for the game on the Saturday, only to get there and the game was called off. And they had to go and do it again on the Monday, and they, you know, went through it all and stayed overnight. So they were properly prepared, you know. I mean, as Keith said, there were players with Football League experience. They knew the job, but the club made sure that they were in the right frame of mind. They were properly prepared and everything was ready for it. And you know, Colin said to me he felt that the performance at Newcastle was even better than the one that they gave it everything. And you know, it would have to be. I mean, obviously, on a better pitch. I mean, people always say, oh, well, it was the pitch that helped Hereford do it. Nothing wrong with St James's Park, I wouldn't have thought, you know, and Hereford got a draw away from home up at St James's Park. So, you know, they went a long way to winning the tie with the way that they played at Newcastle. Because, again, you know, speaking to Colin, when a couple of times that the Newcastle had come down for the game and it was called off and stuff, and he said the second time that they inspected the pitch at 4 o'clock, there was no way it was going to be on the called it off. And Joe Harvey was the manager, Keith Birkinshaw was his assistant, and Colin said, come round the house and have a cup of tea before you get on your way home. And he said, so they came round, his kids were running around the house and all that. Keith had a cup of tea, as Keith would. Nothing exciting for Keith. And he said, I asked Joe what he wanted, and Joe Harvey said, you wouldn't have a glass of whiskey, would you, Colin? And he said, I could see the strain in his face. You know, he was coming down to Hereford and he could see the worst was going to happen. And he said that always made a big mark on him right the way through his career, the sort of the strain in management. I think Newcastle could see that they were in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Absolutely. I mean, Keith, this is a Newcastle team. You know, when you get them in the draw, you know, you've got to be delighted.
Any First Division club, I think at the time, Hereford were prepared to take on. Obviously, the next round, they played West Ham in the fourth round and got a replay in that and went to Upton Park. So, I don't think they feared anyone at the time. They were such a collective group that they worked extremely hard together and always backing each other up. Back in the day, just the one substitute available as well. So they were a very close-knit unit and they didn't fear anyone. And why not? They had nothing to lose as a non-league team. Take on the best and see what you can do. And, you know, there was some pretty good individual performances as well. Along the way, Dudley Tyler got his move to West Ham immediately after Hereford's cup run. I think it was a record transfer fee back in those days between a non-league club and a First Division club. So, you know, there were players in there with, you know, really good skill and ability. So, okay, it was a wonder strike, wasn't it, from Ron Radford? But apart from that, though, you know, there were some decent football played in there. It's such a muddy pitch. And you mentioned muddy pitches, but I look at some of the footage back in the early 70s of the likes of Derby, and I was a pit of Manchester City. I think they were absolute puddings, really, of a pitch and glue pots. So it wasn't just at Edgar Street, I think, but it was just a severe couple of winters, I think, in the early 70s. If you look back through, there were some horrible pitches on show.
Oh, completely, completely. Bill, up in the northeast, many recollections of the build-up to this game. You know, drawn Hereford in the third round. Is there any kind of standout of memories surrounding this game prior to the big moment?
Not prior, because probably most people looked at the game and thought, "Lucky Newcastle! You know, they've got a non-league side at home. They're going to walk it, aren't they?" So I think everybody assumed that they were going to win. So we didn't. It wasn't really that much excitement or interest. Although, as Keith said, it pulled in 39,000 spectators. So it was the result, really, that got the reaction rather than the expectation, because nobody really expected Hereford to win up here. Dudley Tyler, I watched the game today, and he looked like George Best. I mean, it might have been the game of his life. I don't know, Keith, but he looked absolutely magnificent. And he could control the ball. He was skillful. He was beating people. So the pitch really wasn't all that bad. But he looked fantastic.
No, I love Dudley. He's a really skillful player. He's still around. He co-hosts with me on BBC Hereford and Worcester on occasions. He's still around and still as bubbly as ever. And I think he was held back, really. I think he did have a heart condition, a little bit like Asa Hartford. You may remember he also went through a similar sort of scenario. So he was late coming into the semi-professional and then professional game. I think his first goal for West Ham was against Peter Shilton. Not quite sure of that, in the first division. So he got a bit homesick, I think, in the end, and came back to help Hereford go up the divisions what is now the Championship, second division. So really good on the ball, quite zippy, both feet, quite sort of a lanky sort of player. So sometimes you didn't expect him to have quite as much speed and pace as he did, but very tricky. Quick feet, very skillful, and he could move the ball around, and a great crosser of the ball, which obviously likes of Billy Meadows thrived on.
Fantastic. I mean, Keith, if you can flesh out a few of the other players, the standout players of this Hereford side, obviously, you know, Ricky George and Ronnie Radford, so synonymous with what we all watch from a distance and see the goals trip up, you know, time and time again. Joyfully. Some of the other names that would fall under the radar for a lot of listeners.
A lot of listeners wouldn't know about Roger Griffiths. He was a right back and a local lad, played for Worcester as well as Hereford along the way. But he broke his leg in a collision with Fred Potter and Malcolm McDonald early in the match, sort of a hairline fracture, but carried on playing. It's just unbelievable to think back that you would go through pain to that extent. And he didn't let Hereford down during the 60, 70 minutes in which he played. So, you know, he would be a standout. Mick McLaughlin, I think Ricky George used to call him Iron Man, because he was just brutal at the back, took no notice whatsoever. It didn't matter if your name was Malcolm McDonald or whatever. He would just, you know, stand his ground and fight for you. Tony Goff was the instrumental player, the experienced midfield player. He was the one that would pick out the passes, and he marshalled the troops, really, alongside Colin Addison. I mean, Addo was excellent in marshalling teams around him, and it was good to have him on the pitch, I think. I don't think Hereford would have been quite the force if Colin Addison hadn't been playing in the team. You can get a manager who's very motivated, and you have a coach, player coach, maybe. So that worked to Hereford's advantage. Fred Potter, the goalkeeper, actually started as an outfield player, I think, at the likes of Aston Villa and Doncaster Rovers. It was an inside right. I actually saw him in a reserve game at Hereford. It might have been Gornal or Darlaston or something like that. And he actually scored a hat-trick as an outfield player. So it just showed you how talented he was. But again, he was a fearless goalkeeper, and he put his body on the line with on-rushing strikers. And another standout. But you could go through them all, to be fair. They all became sort of legends, especially around here. I still live in the area. They have the reunions once a year, but with so many now, unfortunately, departing, there's quite a few during the COVID period. There's not so many around now which to have that reunion. But it was good to see number 11 score against Portsmouth in last year's FA Cup match at Edgar Street, when there was a huge banner about Motson's commentary with Radford scoring that tremendous goal. But so, you know, still one of the biggest moments, I think, in Hereford's history, without a doubt.
Dave, just going back to that Newcastle side, just looking down the lineup, there's six players who will play in the 1974 FA Cup final. One of them will go on to be a European Cup winner in 1979 with Nottingham Forest. There's another two in that starting lineup who didn't play in the 74 FA Cup final, but did play in the 76 League Cup final. This is a Newcastle United side, you know, packed with talent and, you know, a high-priced goal scorer that thinks that football should be revolving slightly around him, maybe.
There's a story in the music industry about Van Morrison, and they say there are two people, as far as Van Morrison's concerned. There are people who like him, and there are people who have met him. That's pretty much how I feel about Malcolm McDonald. This game's got everything, but particularly the fact that Malcolm McDonald misses a couple of sitters just elevates it to some other plane, I think. No, I mean, but seriously, it's a really strong Newcastle team, isn't it? You know, Frank Clark, as you say, went on and won the European Cup. Pat Howard was a great centre half for years. Bobby Moncur had picked up the first cup of, you know, 2 or 3 years earlier. McDonald, John Tudor was a really underrated player. I always thought Terry Ebbett was a terrific player. You know, it's important when you talk to younger people about these games. There was none of the squad rotation that, you know, causes upsets these days in FA Cup games. I mean, that's Newcastle's first team. That's the team that Joe Harvey would have wanted to pick for the game. Two occasions, they were second best. You can't do any more than that. You know, it's not one of those ones where the big team hits the crossbar six times and he's encamped in the opposition 18-yard box and just can't score. And then there's a breakaway. I mean, that's not how this game, well, it's not how either of the games went. Hereford gave as good as they got right the way through. I was watching the same highlights as Bill earlier today on YouTube, but 15, 20 minutes of the game. Hereford are every bit as good and could have scored a couple, two, three more goals themselves. They could easily have won that comfortably in the end. It's a remarkable thing. And it's just, you know, I've banged on about this in some of the other stuff we've done, particularly the 70s series. But the FA Cup in that period, there is something, you know, there's some magic dust sprinkling. You know, you think the year before is Leeds Colchester. And then this year it's Newcastle Hereford. The following year it's Sunderland Leeds. And everything that you think about the FA Cup is that period. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Within that couple of years, three seasons, everything that builds the sort of iconography of the FA Cup in the television era, comes about then, you know, and obviously this one, you know, is routinely talked about as the greatest FA Cup tie of all time. You know, when you think, you know, you've got the Matthews final in there and, you know, Sunderland's win and all that other stuff. I mean, that's some accolade, but I think it's fair comment.
And Keith, do you remember much of the build-up to the game? I mean, given the amount of postponements there was, did that take away from any nervousness approaching the game, or did it go the opposite way? Was there a build-up of each postponement, or how did that work?
I think they sort of built up and probably helped Hereford's team in a way, because obviously they'd be getting messages from Colin Addison saying, oh, look, they are a bit concerned about this. They're fed up about coming up and down the country. Game's been called off again. And so I think as a child, I certainly remember, you know, schoolmates and everything being desperate to get this game on and wanting it to be played. And so it was almost a relief when the kickoff did actually take place, because this game had been built up and built up and built up, and you just wanted to get on with it. And I'm sure that the players did as well. But maybe Newcastle looked at it and thought, well, we're not quite so sure about this after all now. And then they got a draw at St James's Park. Maybe it isn't going to be as easy as we thought. And we mentioned Malcolm McDonald. I'm sure you're all aware that Ted McDougall scored 9 goals, I think it was, for Bournemouth against Margate in the previous round of the FA Cup. And so somebody at Northern Echo or something up in the northeast, a journalist had got a photograph of McDonald with his two hands up going, I'm going to score 10. And this photograph was reproduced. And if you ask Colin Addison, he actually stuck that up in the dressing room as an extra incentive. Look at what this man is going to do to you, and we'll show him. And I think that was a bit of a motivation to get the job done as well. A, stop him as much as you can, and also get one over the so-called big head of Newcastle.
He never learned, did he?
Never learned, no. Certainly not.
No, absolutely. I mean, within the game itself, Keith, McDonald opens the scoring. And again, does that kind of help Hereford's, you know, shoulders ease a little bit? You know, does this play kind of into Hereford's hands a little bit?
Well, I don't think so. You talk to John Watson, sadly we can't any longer. I was so lucky to work with him for a few years, and Ricky George. We used to do Ladbrokes Premier previews in video. But he, as he quite rightly said, you know, even in his voice, that's it, 1-0. McDonald's got, you know, the opening goal. That tie's over. I'm only going to get 20 seconds of highlights on Match of the Day. And then, obviously, events transpire to give him his real breakthrough in broadcasting commentary. So, no, I think it really it was a question of we're still in it. We had to fight back from 2-1 down at St James's Park. We can do it again. We've still got time to rectify it. And who knows who's going to be the fittest team, who's used to playing on a glue pot of a pitch. If we get to extra time, maybe we'll get the upper hand. And that's pretty much what happened.
I mean, Bill, as games go, this has, when we said it earlier on, it has absolutely everything. You know, a great believer in kind of how football can diffuse itself in many ways. The tension of a situation can be kind of, I don't know, diffused a little bit by, I don't know, when that concept of what's the worst that can happen, and then the worst happens, and it's like, well, actually, we can navigate a way around, you know, the worst that has happened. You know, it's not always detrimental to fall behind in football matches. Sometimes it can be the opposite way around. And especially in this case, you know, Malcolm McDonald opens the scoring, and surely he and his teammates, I've seen the footage as well. And that tone of John Motson's voice, it's like, oh, that's the worst thing that can happen for this tie. But, you know, it can work the opposite way around, can't it?
Getting the equaliser so quickly was the trick, wasn't it? And Hereford never stopped working. They never stopped going for every single tackle. I mean, as Dave said, it was a completely deserved, you know, draw at 90 minutes and then going on to win. But the fight was just incredible. And I think we'll go back to magic as well. I mean, nothing could have been better than that day, could it? Especially with Keith being 12. Because at 12, you still believe in magic. And you're old enough to remember it. And you know, even the, you know, a goal behind probably made it a more exciting game, didn't it? It just added to the story and the tension and the passion. And McDonald missing those chances as well. I mean, wasn't that wonderful? After what he'd said about scoring 10 goals, how wonderful that he missed two sitters. As Dave said, it couldn't happen to a nicer man.
Hey, Dave. It is a, you know, a game of football where, I don't know, I mean, Newcastle United, I mean, obviously Bill's got a vested interest in the North East here as being with a Sunderland hat on. But, you know, I think away from the North East, they're not the most dislikable club, you know, historically at least. You know, that is, you know, I think within the process of changing a little bit. But, you know, this is, you know, the fact that Newcastle remained the eternal punchline to the FA Cup third round is quite, and they've not won it either this side of this iconic match. The kind of cursed and blessed to be on the receiving end of this result.
They were the cup team, weren't they, in the 50s? I mean, three FA Cup wins, which, you know, the 50s wasn't that far away at that point. But on the commentary, John Motson saying something like they haven't got to the fourth round in 12 years or something at that point. So they're obviously having a terrible time in there. In the FA Cup over that stretch. So, you know, they've got to be going there feeling, oh God, this is not going to be our day. We talked about the magic bills, just mentioned it again. And even the postponements play into that, because otherwise this is played on a nondescript Wednesday night and it gets 5 minutes on Sports Night with Coleman. As it is, it's played on fourth round day. It gets the full Match of the Day treatment. And, you know, it becomes the game that it does in terms of the television. Coverage is just one of those things that's blessed with absolutely everything that it needs. I mean, you talk about Michael McDonald's goal. I mean, the big thing about that goal is it's 82 minutes. There's only 8 minutes left to save the game, you know. And obviously, not only do they save the game, they go and win it. But I mean, yeah, as you've all said, the tone of Motson's commentary is, oh, man, there we go. That's the end of that. Because there's no time left for him to rescue it, but they rescue it with the goal of the season, the goal of the decade, the goal of the century, I suppose, hadn't it?
Radford. Now Tudor's gone down for Newcastle. Radford again. Oh, what a goal! What a goal! Radford the scorer, Ronnie Radford, and the crowd The crowd are invading the pitch, and now it will take some time to clear the field.
It's just ludicrous, the whole thing.
I mean, Keith, if you can encapsulate, you know, how, you know, what it felt to see, you know, Ronnie Radford strike that incredible equaliser and turn the game completely on its head.
Well, I actually didn't see the ball hit the back of the net. As I said, there were so many kids. We were all on these hay bales and benches at behind the goal at the other end, the Newcastle end. Every time we were on the attack, there'd be a slight surge and we'd all sort of jump up and down. I saw Radford hit strike the ball, but I never actually saw it hit the back of the net until I saw Match of the Day cameras in the evening, because it was just euphoric. The whole thing was played in a bizarre atmosphere. I'd never heard Hereford's Meadow End called the Cop before John Motson described it as in commentary at one point. And so you mentioned there were people up trees, up the floodlight pylons. But yeah, Ronnie's goal is, you'll never beat that. I mean, you have to watch and give credit to the cameraman, because he actually had to move the camera in, still within, you know, keeping it in focus all the way past McFall's outstretched arm, right into the top corner, and then comes the invasion onto the pitch. But it was so far out that literally, I don't think you'd ever do it anymore. And so I think the balls back then were slightly heavier. They did take up a bit of moisture, and that probably enabled Radford's strike to absolutely go in like an Exocet missile into the top corner. Probably never going to be repeated. And it's so good to see it even now. Every time there's an FA Cup, especially Cup match on BBC, that goal is always shown somewhere in the build-up to FA Cup weekends, or as it is now, FA Cup weeks. And that's to the detriment of the FA Cup. They should still be played at 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, whatever the TV schedules say. And that's ruined it. And likewise with no cup replays, are trying to get rid of those. I mean, the whole thing is that Hereford epitomised the FA Cup in many ways. They had beaten other sides in the 50s and 60s, so it wasn't just a one-off. And they did build so much momentum getting, and the gates were going right up. Some of the Football League clubs couldn't believe the attendances that were going into Edgar Street. So it was just that bandwagon, and sort of Radford's goal sort of epitomised. That was the pinnacle, really, you could say, of that as it flew in. And of course, Ricky George got the winner in extra time. But yeah, it was tremendous scenes. You were just jubilant. The fact that, you know, A, we'd equalised against all odds, and then to go on and win it. So the whole city and the county, we've got exiles still to this day. And in the fanzine that we mentioned, Talking Ball, we did a special Giant Killers edition. We had to have reprints of that. I think there were over 1,000 of those sold in the end. It was incredible. And we did it from the perspective of what the fans thought. We'd all heard what the players and the managers and the journalists had all thought, but we'd never really got to grips with what, you know, the fans like me felt like. And so to read up what they experienced as they went through, and the fact that they went up to Newcastle and the trains were late or whatever. So it all builds into a tremendous story. I'm amazed they never made a film about it, to be honest, because what a film that would make.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, Dave, we'll come to Ricky George's winner very soon. But this game becomes the watchword of, you know, giant killing acts, and it remains the benchmark in that respect for anyone who has seen this. And, you know, I've grown up around the lore of this game. You know, it was two years before I was born, but, you know, I can't remember, you know, a year of my childhood without this goal slipping up on television. You know, in the build up to the third round. And, you know, that focus on, you know, which game might provide the, you know, the next version of this.
Yeah, I mean, it was a hugely unexpected, you know, in the wider context of football, hugely unexpected that Newcastle would get beaten over the two games. I suppose particularly before the first one, obviously, but St James's Park, everybody would have expected them to win. But it's not just the winning, it's the whole thing. I mean, I was looking earlier today that the attendance, the official attendance, It's 14,313, which, I mean, Colin Addison said to me that it looked like the ground was full twice over. I mean, he told me the story before the first game up at Newcastle. They had a meeting with the chief of police in Hereford, and they agreed that the capacity was going to be 15,000. That was it. Not going to let anybody but more than 15,000. So they got they played the game, drew the game, come back. And there was another board meeting after the Newcastle game up at St James's Park. And they decided, this is how many tickets we're going to sell. And Colin Addison was in the boardroom with them. And the secretary came in and said, we've got a problem. We've sold out of tickets for the game. So the chairman said to him, don't worry about it, Arthur. Just print some more. And he turned to the chief of police was there. He turned to the chief of police and he said, that'll be all right, won't it? Yes, chairman, but not too many. That's how it was then. I mean, that does, of course, then lead to all kinds of terrible events within football. But, there's that kind of, not only is it a great giant killing act and all the goals and all that, but it represents a different era of football. There's an innocence to it and a naivety to it. And you can't help but look at that, all the pitch invasions, all three pitch invasions, and you've got to smile at it, we're joking about the Parkers and all that sort of stuff. And I don't know that if you had a pitch invasion like that now, people wouldn't feel the same way about it. It's a different, there'd be something sort of sinister about it now, wouldn't there? And it'd be health and safety and all that kind of stuff. Perhaps rightly so.
It wouldn't happen because of VAR. You can't celebrate anymore. You've got to wait 5, 6, 10, 12 minutes before you can say, oh, yeah, we've scored after all.
Everybody's going home by then. But, I think it does represent, that a golden era of the FA Cup, but also a different feel about football when football was the most important thing in the world and we didn't take it seriously at the same time, which is a trick that we've lost along the way somewhere.
Yeah, definitely. It's a different vibe now. Very much taken seriously, to bizarre extents. But at this moment, Keith, Ricky George enters the fray, and Roddy Radford plays an integral role in the build up to this goal as well. It's a wonderfully worked move too, and the way he, I don't know whether it's intentional or the way he slips the defence. He goes one way, the ball goes the other, and he catches up with it and rolls it into the corner. It's a beautifully well-worked goal. It's not got the Hollywood punchline of Radford's screamer, but this is still an absolutely magnificent goal in a completely different way.
Yeah, close range, wasn't it? Right position. Just got the angle right to go again past McFall into the opposite corner. I do wonder sometimes whether Dudley tried to get the ball a little bit into a different position than it actually went straight at Ricky. But as you say, a good quick turn and then slotted it in. But again, tremendous scenes from the Meadow end, especially when that ball just about made the back of the net.
Billy Meadows, away by Moncur, Radford, Tyler, George. George has done it. What a moment for Hereford.
Yeah, I mean, Ricky was a sort of player that was frustrating at times, but he had some skill, and there's a couple of pieces in the footage that you can see. I think he wins the ball midway inside the Newcastle half at one point, and a little shimmy, as you say, and a good pass there. So, he wasn't too far away. He'd started at Tottenham in the early 60s when Tottenham won the double. So he got a bit of history. Ronnie Radford was sort of a youngster up at Leeds United. So again, some of these players that they went under the radar, but on that particular or in that particular year, I should say, it all came right, and they all fitted tremendously well together. And so it was very much a team, very much a squad performance. Yeah,
fantastic. And Bill, in the Hearn household, How did this moment go down?
Well, obviously, without not as well as it went down in Hereford, because I mean it is just the most magical moment in Hereford, but it went down pretty well. It's up there with the 74 FA Cup final, where Liverpool beat Newcastle 3-0. That's mainly because of the nature of the annihilation. But yeah, it's nice to see. I think Len Shackleton said it. He says, "I'm not biased. I don't care who beats Newcastle." And I feel much the same way. If I could take Keith back to this idea of a film, what was Hereford like on the Monday of the West Ham replay? I agree with you, Keith, that games should kick off at 3 o'clock on a Saturday or midweek at 7:45, 7:30. But this was a Monday afternoon, wasn't it? Did you have to go to school? What was it like for 10,000 Hereford fans to get down to West Ham for a Monday afternoon?
Yeah, well, we had the first tie was a goalless draw at Edgar Street first. I think that was in May. My memory is not quite clear on it, but I think we had to play West Ham on the Wednesday following Newcastle on the Saturday. I'm not absolutely sure on that, but it was certainly very close. So then you've got Bobby Moore and Jeff Hurst rolling into town. So you didn't have much time to get tickets sorted and make sure you got in for that one, but you know, they announced that as just under 15,000 as well, but I'm sure there were probably more once again for a 0-0 draw. And then you had time to savour it because they got a replay and we're now off to Upton Park. 3-day week, game played, as you say, in the afternoon. No floodlights because it was electricity cuts, etc. I think there were thousands and thousands because they did. It was just bedlam, I think. Everybody wanted to be there. And because it had got national acclaim now, it wasn't just Hereford and West Ham supporters, but everybody in London, it seemed, wanted to be to that one. And there were people up on, couldn't get in. There's photographs of people up on tower blocks. So you could see sort of a quarter or a half of the pitch from the very top of the tower block overlooking Upton Park. So it was just tremendous. And everybody had belief still that Hereford could get a result even down there, having drawn 0-0 and hit, I think Brian Owen hit the crossbar in the game at Edgar Street. So they weren't far away from doing it then. Obviously, a couple of years later, when Hereford were in the league, they did beat West Ham in the FA Cup. Mervyn Day, I remember, was the goalkeeper, and likes of Dudley played against West Ham again because he'd come back. Like Sir Brian Evans was playing for Hereford. So the whole thing turned full circle. But in the build-up to that first game at Upton Park, everybody, and I mean every sort of football fan who could get there, I think one from London, was going to get there. There were trains laid on from Hereford, special football trains to get as many people there as possible. But some of them arrived too late. So it was a real shame that you know, they had to listen to it on the radio and no stream TV or any such thing in those days. So you're just desperate to keep up with what was happening. For some people, we had letters in to Talking Ball about it saying, look, we tried our very best to get there and we couldn't get in and that sort of thing. So, you know, for some people, yeah, the result was bad, but it was just a day. It was a real day of experience, day out in London one way or another. People were going to enjoy it.
So how did 12-year-old Keith keep up to date with the score? Were you at school? Or?
I was at school. I wasn't allowed to go to Upton Park. Foot down. Very few away games I made as a 12-year-old, to be fair. Virtually made every home game. But it was the radio. That's all that you could do. Some people would ring up and try and get a score that way. Believe it or not, you could ring up clubs in those days and then somebody would answer the phone, maybe the secretary or whoever. You know, what's the score? Oh, it's 2-0 to West Ham. Jeff Hurst has got both or whatever. And talking about the phones, there's a story that going right back to the St James's match. John Motson was reporting on it for radio. Was it Radio 2 in those days? Or anyway,
yeah, well, I mean,
there weren't enough phone lines at St James's Park for him to get his report through in time. So he had to leave St James's Park, jog down the road, find a phone box and do his match report to BBC on a normal phone line in a phone box with 10 pence coins. And that's a true story. So it just shows you how things have moved on from keeping up to date with scores on mobile phones and apps and streaming this, that, and you know, and everything. Those were the days when you had to work hard, even as a journalist, to even get a match report out, let alone a commentary.
Fabulous, fabulous story there. Dave, this is an incredible week and a half for Hereford. There is just 4 days that split, you know, the victory over Newcastle in that replay to the Wednesday when it's West, the visit of West Ham, and then the following Monday for the replay. This sets Hereford up nicely for election to the Football League. There's no turning them down after this, is there?
Absolutely not. And I mean, you know, you've got to give them huge credit for the West Ham game on the Wednesday, because you've beaten Newcastle on the Saturday. There's all the emotion and the everything that goes with that. You see it today. I mean, you always see it in football. You come to the top of the mountain, you win this game that you shouldn't have won, and it's a huge event. And then the next game's a damp sweep. You know, you struggle to get yourself going. So to play as well as they did against West Ham, you know, just 4 days later, was a fantastic achievement. As both Keith and Bill have said, you know, lots of good players in that team. Dudley Tyler obviously was the sort of the one that the people picked out, because he was very much that 70s kind of player, run, you know, would run with the ball, that sort of maverick, you know, that was in vogue at the time. But a lot of really good players. But as you say, you know, we've talked a lot about re-election in the 70s series that we did, and still talking about it in the 80s series. It was just such a bizarre concept that, you know, you got to vote for somebody to go out of the league and somebody to come in, rather than, you know, proper, you know, relegation and promotion decided on where you finish in leagues. But no, can you imagine the headlines that all those chairmen would have got from the third and fourth division if they decided Hereford weren't getting in? I mean, there's no way. Could you stop it? I mean, it was just, you know, a snowball rolling downhill, wasn't it? After that win over Newcastle, they had to be in the league.
It was close though. It was tied with Barrow, the first vote. They had to have a rerun of the vote before Hereford got in. So even with all of that good publicity and the massive crowds for Southern League matches, let alone FA Cup games, even then, the old pals act almost closed the door once again. The right decision, I think, was made in the end, as we could see from the next 15, 20 years. But at the time, I think everybody felt hard done by when we got the news that, you've got the same number of votes as Barrow. But obviously, second vote minutes later rectified it. But it was a very difficult time to be a non-league side, I think, actually, to try and break in to the elite of the 92.
Absolutely. But just a quick nod towards what was to come in the following seasons. Obviously, that election to the Football League comes at the end of 1971-72. Sweep through Division 4. They're into the second division by 1976. It's, you know, an immediate return to the third division. But, you know, for Hereford, as you know, as an area, just what was happening with the football team at that point in time must have been mind-blowing.
Well, we've sort of touched on it already. Hereford was probably around 40, 50 miles from its nearest neighbour in terms of a football club. And back in those days, football was probably the number one activity you'd go and watch. So the catchment area was so good. And that when you're on a bandwagon and you're getting really good results, people will come from here, there and everywhere. And that was the case back in the early 70s to get Hereford up the divisions. But I think a step too far when they got in the second division in reality. But I think finances were still right on the edge. I remember they sold the top scorer, Dixie McNeil, a couple of seasons later to Wrexham, and he went on to European glory in the Cup Winners' Cup. And people like that, in many ways, that was the best Hereford team ever. Not the eight giant killers. You've got them in a box, and you're never going to fail to see and give them the accolades that they deserve. But the side that actually won the third division championship, I think, was probably the best Hereford team will ever see. I mean, and then they did, but for injuries, and I think they're only 3 points off getting out of or staying up in the second division with a good run against likes of Alan Ball and Peter Osgood for Southampton back in those days, and a draw at Molineux, I seem to recall as well, a 2-2 draw. So they weren't far away, but it just possibly was a, you know, one division too soon, because I think it was 4 years from election into the league to then playing some really big clubs at a higher level. So, you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing, but it was very enjoyable at the time, I can tell you. We all felt as kids that, you know, Hereford just don't lose. It doesn't happen very often at all. So we were all on a high all the way through, I think, for five or six years, certainly.
How much did you dare dream, Keith? Because you mentioned that you fancied yourself to beat West Ham. The next round, you got Huddersfield away, really, really struggling Huddersfield. Were you starting to think of Wembley?
I'm sure somebody would have said that at the time, but I don't think so, really. It was just one after another. We did look at that, and I think Frank Worthington was playing for Huddersfield at the time in the first division, and he was a maverick, another one of those that we talk about. They electrified football in the early 70s, likes of Stan Bowles, maybe George Best, obviously. There were some iconic players, and every team seemed to have a star one way or another. It's not like today when you might get a club with 30, 40, 50 players in a squad, and they could pick six or seven out. But everybody seemed to have a superstar who would, you know, get the fans in supporting their local club. And so for me, I think the 70s was probably a highlight of the Football League, as it were, back in the day. You can argue for different periods, but having lived through it, and I see footage still pops up on my mobile phone daily, and it's great to watch some of these games from late 60s, early 70s, and you see some wonderful goals along the way. And obviously, none will surpass Ronnie Radford's, but it's great to see some of the Charlie Cook, I think it was another one at Chelsea. They were players that, as you say, were really tricky, very skillful, and they wouldn't go down. I mean, I've seen footage of George Best once, and he was almost assaulted three or four times before he got anywhere near the penalty area. These days, the manager would tell him as soon as he gets the slightest shove, go down, we'll have the free kick, thank you very much. But football changes, not necessarily for the best. But yeah, I think the 70s was a magical period, without a doubt.
And Bill, on the streets of the Northeast in the days that followed this, we've already spoke about the Hearn household, but you know, in the wider Northeast, how did this go down?
Well, the Northeast's a funny place. There's 12 miles between Sunderland and Newcastle. It's not like Liverpool, Everton, where you sort of mix on a daily basis. So there was plenty of gloating in Sunderland, but it wasn't really sort of face-to-face gloating. But yeah, it was just an enjoyable week or two, basking in what was a great result for us and an even better one for Hereford.
Excellent stuff. And just a quick tester for you, Bill and Dave. Dave, West Brom's fortunes in the third round of the FA Cup, can you think of them off the top of the head from 1971-72?
We had a period at the back end of the 60s into the, where obviously they won the FA Cup and they got to the semi-final in 69 and lost. And then from there, they couldn't win a game for three or four years in the Cup. I mean, maybe we got through the first round in 71-2, I can't remember. There was no more glory. In fact, there hasn't been any more glory since 1968.
Well, West Brom, I can tell you, were beaten 2-1 at home by Coventry City in the third round.
We're losing to Coventry, it was a pretty bad year.
Pretty bad year. Bill, any thoughts on where Sunderland?
Yeah, I'm moderately certain we beat Sheffield Wednesday 3-0 in the third round. We then played Cardiff, and I think we drew at home and drew away. And in those days, obviously, as Keith said, you know, the second replay at Main Road, we'd been drawn to play Leeds, but we lost to Cardiff 3-1. And had we played Leeds, it would have been a rehearsal for the following season's FA Cup final.
Absolutely. And Liverpool, from my perspective, Liverpool went out in a fourth round replay at the hands of said Leeds United there. So a potential Liverpool Sunderland fifth round was upset by the team from Ellen Road and Ninian Park there. Brilliant. Really enjoyed this. Keith, thank you so much for spending an hour with us talking about Hereford's greatest, certainly the greatest FA Cup moment without a shadow of a doubt. And I think the game that is the most synonymous, certainly visually, for a generation, the footage still exists. And there it is in glorious colour as well, with John Motson calling it as well. It is the go-to giant killing of the third round, without a doubt. Thanks so much for joining us, Keith.
Absolutely. I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
And Dave and Bill, have you enjoyed our episode one of the Giant Killer series?
Yeah, very much. It's great to hear Keith. I mean, his views on football coincide completely with mine. I'm so glad that I haven't experienced VAR. That's one of the good things about not being in the Premier Division. But yeah, it's been great.
And Dave?
Yeah, I can't talk about this game often enough, quite frankly. It's one of those things that, you know, whenever you're feeling a bit disenchanted with football, if you go and find the 15 minutes of this on YouTube, it restores your faith in everything, I think.
Fantastic. It is you know, an absolute icon of football. And Aidan Williams, we can only apologise for bringing this game up. Yet again, he's grown up on the shadow of this game as Aidan. But yeah, wonderful. And there's no doubt about it, this will come back to the fore again at some point on podcast very, very soon. All that leaves me to do is say thank you for listening. This has been another podcast from These Football Times. Please do join us again when we'll be covering another giant killing act in the fourth round. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.